Good day, and welcome to the AerCap Financial Europe conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Mr. Chris Ross-Roberts. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the AerCap Financial Europe S.A. TCAF RAIF quarterly investor presentation for the period ending the 30th of December 2019. As set out on page two of the presentation, Justin, Ed, and I will take you through the presentation, and then we'll open the line to Q&A at the session at the end. In addition to the Q&A session, please remember you can send questions through to info@aercapfe.com or through the website at www.aercapfe.com, where we'll endeavor to reply to them as soon as we can. Details can be found at the end of the presentation. Before I begin, can I please draw your attention to the disclaimer on page one of the presentation, which highlights that the presentation is produced solely for informational purposes and cautions against any forward-looking statements, and that by attending this call and reviewing the presentation, you're agreeing to the limitations set out on page one of the presentation. Today, before I hand over to Justin, I would just like to make a few comments re COVID-19. Firstly, all of our estimates, forecasts, forward-looking statements, and following commentary on the results were prepared before taking into account quickly moving events in each country's response to the COVID-19 virus. We would now anticipate that given very recent events, which includes the closure of courts and suspension of auctions in Italy until at least the end of March and likely beyond Easter, and that in Spain, the closure of schools and universities in Madrid being seen as a first step, that this may or will have a negative impact on collections in the short term. We will be ensuring we preserve liquidity in the near term and will keep the situation under constant review. I'd now like to hand over to Justin to take you through the presentation.
Thanks, Chris, and good afternoon, everyone. After falling short of a very significant target in Q4, gross collections achieved 92% of overall forecast for 2019, totaling 125 million euros. However, consistent with a highly variable cost model and due to the implementation of more cost-effective resolution strategies, operating costs were a full 20% below forecast. With this, together with low fixed costs, AerCap's total operating cost ratio, including all overheads, came in at just under 26%. Following Q4 shortfall in collections, the company completed its biannual review of all portfolios and in its reforecast, prudently pushed out the overall timing of collections on its predominantly secured portfolio further. This resulted in a gross non-cash impairment of 35.9 million, 58% of which was in Spain. And following on from what was a significant year for acquisitions in 2018, AerCap only invested 36.5 million euros in 2019, limiting collections from new portfolio acquisitions throughout the year. As a result, leverage came in at just over 3.8 times net debt to last 12 months adjusted EBITDA, with significant liquidity available for new opportunities. While AerCap maintains a primary focus on secured NPLs, we remain committed to maintaining pricing discipline in the face of continued strong competition for assets, and also continue to explore other highly cash-generative and real estate-backed opportunities where AerCap has a broader track record. In order to exploit the best risk-adjusted returns, AerCap continued to develop its asset management operations within AerCap, further enhancing its master servicing model in order to both optimize value and address challenges when they arise. This includes significant further development in Spain, including the internalization of servicing on select segments of our portfolio, as well as further team build-out in the U.K., Portugal, and Italy. I will now turn it back over to Chris for more detail on our financial results.
Thank you, Justin. I'm going to quickly cover the normal financial highlights before spending some more time explaining the non-cash impairment we announced in our trading update. Ed will build on this by going into some country-specific detail on our ERC and underlying collateral before updating you on AerCap's asset management platform. So if we can turn to page seven, key financial highlights, AerCap financials. slower collections in Q4 and lower deployment during the year, impacting LTM adjusted EBITDA. As you heard from Justin, Q4 targets were short of plan by around $10.2 million, resulting in a full-year collections of $125 million compared to the previous year of $134 million, a drop of 6.6%. The shortfall in Q4 was predominantly in Spain, $7.8 million behind, with other shortfalls being in Italy of 1.2 and Portugal of 2.8, offset by overperformance in Poland, Romania and the UK. Notwithstanding the shortfall in collections, revenue is up year on year to circa $81 million, an increase of 6.6% driven by deployment in 2018. This is likely to decline slightly given the deployment profile in 2019. As you heard from Justin, total operating costs were significantly lower than originally forecast and in aggregate relatively flat at $32 million for the year. We had anticipated a big jump following the large volume of portfolio purchases in 2018. A combination of selective internalization, changing collection strategy to lower cost alternatives resulted in a significant cost saving. Clearly, lower collections in Q4 also impacted the total spend. Although I know I've said this before, and it's worth noting that operating cost ratio we refer to is the total operating costs, excluding non-recurring items, rather than a cost-to-collect ratio, and therefore includes all overheads of the business. Our overhead structure is predominantly variable and relative to the value of portfolios held in the business. In summary, AFB's total operating costs remain market-leading. LTM adjusted EBITDA has decreased by 6.9% to $90.3 million as Q4 collections were delayed into the future. The lower-than-planned deployment in the year meant ERC dropped to $525.3 million, a decline of 10%. We have a go into the year with sufficient liquidity and a pipeline of opportunities that Justin will cover later in the presentation. Leverage based on the LTM adjusted EBITDA has increased moderately to 3.83 times, notwithstanding that net debt at the year end at $345.9 million is down $17.3 million year on year and remains below the guidance of 4 times. If we can turn to page 8, ERC comparison Q3 2019 versus Q4 2019 post reforecast. Prudent assumptions on timing results in delays in forecast collections with overall ERC quantum in line with previous expectations. Let me start by explaining the graph. The gold bar shows ERC at Q3 results presentation and shows ERC by year of forecast at that time. At the end of Q3 2019, gross attributable collections were $79.5 million, the green bar, with a full-year forecast of $135 million. Since then, $45.5 million has been collected, taking the full-year attributable collections to $125 million. The dark blue bar chart shows ERC year-by-year following the full line-by-line reforecast exercise that is performed with our services every 6 months, on the same set of assets that were owned at the 30th of September. So you can see a static snapshot of the change in timing of ERC. The light blue graph adds the impact of the Q4 deployment to ERC to the revised forecast, giving 84-month ERC at the 31st of December 2019. If we reconcile this, we start with ERC at the 30th of September at $555 million, gross attributable collections in the Q4 of $45.5 million, new ERC from deployment, the sum of the light blue bars is $90 million, less a $5 million change in the value of ERC in the new forecasts, resulting in closing ERC of $525 million at the 31st of December. This is set out on the appendices on page 33, and the change in the value of ERC is less than 1%. The key change, therefore, in the revised forecasts is highlighted by the difference in the bar charts, and that is one of timing of expected collections, with a significant decrease of expected collections in 2020. 37 million less compared to the previous forecast, with timing pushed out to the future. Whilst we still expect to collect 97% of what we expected to collect in the period 2020 to the end of 2023, the change in timing of collections, together with the missing Q4 and a high effective EIR discount rate used to calculate book value, have driven the impairment book this quarter of 36 million. A change in timing in ERC will also impact projected EBITDA for 2020 and the resultant forecast leverage. On the following pages, I'll break this down by country. Turning to page 9. Reforecast comparison of ERC by country. The graphs on page 9 set out by country for Spain, Italy, and Portugal, which accounts 88% of ERC, the changes in timing and quantum between the December forecast and the June forecast. Other includes UK, Romania, and Poland. These are presented on a static basis and excludes the impact of Q4 deployment, so you can see a true like-for-like comparison. The reduction in lifetime ERC comes mainly from Italy and Spain, partly offset by gain in Portugal. Turning to Spain, you'll note from the graph that including the shortfall in 2019 collections, they are forecast to be 33.5 million worse in the period of 2021, before recovering 28.1, a shortfall in the ERC of 5.4 million over previous forecasts. In Spain, we have a number of complex SME portfolios, as well as some more granular portfolios. The change in value is due to a more conservative estimate of realizable value on some of the larger positions. The change in timing is driven by the revised estimate of court timings, given the current backlog in the Spanish courts. To explain that a bit further, as you may recall, there have been several early termination abusive clause complaints by individual consumer borrowers that were escalated to the EU. Whilst this has been ongoing, there have been many suspensions or foreclosures of processes for individuals. The ECJ ruling in March 2019 did not provide much further clarity, and therefore a new Mortgage Act was introduced by the Spanish government in June 2019 and interpreted by the Spanish Supreme Court in September 19 and the Barcelona and Madrid courts in November 19. The good news is that rules are now clear, and whilst a large part of our portfolio is not directly impacted in any event by the ruling, the courts now, unfortunately, have a large backlog of claims as previously suspended claims are restarted. This has led us, together with our services, to build in a significant delay in legal timings within our Spanish portfolios. Turning to Italy, you'll note from the graph that including the shortfall in 2019 collections are forecast to be 13.1 million, worse than the period of 21, before recovering 8.9 million, a shortfall of 4.2 million over previous forecasts. The change in forecasts are mostly over some of the older portfolios and takes into account liquidity in each location and the number of auctions now expected on a line-by-line basis. Turning to Portugal, we see a short-term negative forecast of 18.9 million, followed by a positive uplift of 23.2 million, an increase of 4.3 million. This movement is made up of a number of factors. Firstly, a positive uplift on our unsecured books, driven by improvement in economic outlook and a current higher run rate. Some negative timing impacted, driven by a change in collection strategies in our secured residential portfolios, but significant cost savings resulting in a neutral impact on RR, but a flatter collection curve. And thirdly, a reassessment of timing on a number of complex SME secure portfolios with several positions tied up in complex bankruptcy cases. Overall, which includes UK, Poland and Romania, continues to perform positively with a modest increase in ERC and an overall acceleration. Other outperformed in 2019, and this acceleration has been prudently reversed out of 2020. We can turn to page 10, AFE impairment analysis by country. The graphs on page 10 show book show book value by country before and after impairment. 58% of the impairment is in Spain, driven principally due to regulatory issues. We've seen from the previous page that impairment is principally driven by changes in timing and some country-specific changes in estimates of value. The graph below shows book value pre the revised forecast and the book value following the booking of the impairment. Spain accounted for 58% of the impairment with a write-down of 17% of book value. Italy, which accounts for 39% of total ERC, had an impairment of 7% of book value. I do think it's important to remember that book value is driven off gross cash forecast and does not take into account positive cost savings. Whilst clearly the changes in timing and estimates is frustrating, it gives an overly negative impression on returns we are achieving and the positive cost savings we are achieving and continue to expect to achieve. I will expand on this later in the presentation, but firstly turning to deployment. Turning to page 11, deployment by year and geography. The bar chart sets out deployment by year and geography for AFE over time. Clearly 2019 was the modest year, with 2018 remaining the largest year of deployment. I would therefore like to use 2018 vintage as a case study. So if you turn to page 12, 2018 vintage case study 1 of 2, the table below summarizes the 2018 vintage in aggregate and covers deployment of 161.5 million. We've previously shared with you the summary revenue, gross collections, and cost data for part of this vintage. At underwriting, we were forecasting 240.4 million of lifetime gross collections for the 2018 vintage, with cost of 30.9 million and a positive contribution to adjusted EBITDA of 209.5 million. Following the reforecast, we are now anticipating slightly lower collections, offset by a big reduction in costs. We had originally assumed a high degree of full repossession into REO with all the associated costs. We find that in Portugal in particular, that we're achieving a high degree of resolution by the continuing a judicial approach and achieving sales prior to repossession. Whilst the total gross collections are lower and flatter, there is a significant reduction in costs, and NPV is broadly similar. This is broken out further on the next page. Please note that for balance sheet calculations of book value, which is relevant to impairment, we use gross collections, which differ from attributable gross collections used for ERC. A reconciliation for 2019 collections is on page 34 of the presentation. Turning to page 13. We have set out on this page gross collections, collection costs, and the impact on adjusted EBITDA for the whole of the 2018 vintage. For 2018 and 19 combined, 2020 and 21 to 26 combined. You'll note that gross collections for 2018 to 19 are 54 million against the forecast underwriting of 51 million, 6% ahead of target. Costs for the same period were forecast to be 26% of collections, but ended up being just 6%, a saving of 10 million euros. The EBITDA contribution was 51 million versus a target of 38 million, an increase of 30 million, or 34% ahead of forecast. In summary, the vintage has got off to a very positive start. We've already seen in aggregate that 2018 vintage is expected to contribute a higher level of adjusted EBITDA than originally forecast, notwithstanding that total collection targets have been reduced. However, in the short term, we're expecting to collect less in 2020 than originally forecast. We'll also spend significantly less, 5 million versus 10 million. The change in timing is driven by two key factors: an extension of timing on Spanish collections across the board, 27% of our 2018 deployment was in Spanish portfolios, and a change in strategy in the Portuguese portfolios purchased in 2018. That's a significant cost advantage, but slightly flatter curve, but overall is NPV positive. The impairment booked is calculated purely on gross cash flows, which takes into account the slightly lower collections forecast and the adjustments to timing, but does not take into account the change in costs. Overall, we expect returns from the 2018 vintage to be in line with our overall net target at underwriting. Turning to page 14, key debt metrics and capital structure. Leverage at the 30th of December at 3.83 times is ahead of market guidance, with net debt at the year being $345 million, $17.3 million lower than last year. We have sufficient liquidity for 2020 deployment targets, and at the end of February have $67 million of immediate liquidity available. Both the LTV ratio and the super senior revolving credit ratio are well within covenant levels at 66.2% and 3.7% respectively. As previously discussed, we had expected leverage to decrease in 2020 to within our target range of 3 to 3.5 times. The revised forecast for collection now pushes this out to 2021. We set a deployment target of circa $100 million for 2020, which will result in a modest uptick in leverage by the end of 2020 to just over 4 times, before it drops again to our target range of 3 to 3.5. We are tracking COVID-19 events closely and monitoring the situation, but have yet updated any of our forecasts. Our existing collections forecast for Q1 is modest at $17.2 million. We have at the end of February collected $12.9 million against a target of $10.1 million. Q2 collections target is $32.5 million, of which $14 million is from Italy. Q3 is a similar overall target, with Italy having a lower forecast of $9.7 million in Q3. As usual, Q4 represents a larger quarterly target of 35% of our overall collections. Given we have a low prudent forecast for collections for Q1 of just $17 million, this will result in a short tick up in leverage above the 2020 year-end target. We continue to constantly review our capital structure and liquidity position, and we look to optimize this over time. Depending on market conditions and our operating results, this could include over-market repurchase of securities, amongst other strategies. We've also said that no dividend will be paid off the back of the 2019 results. We do not currently anticipate any dividend in 2020. I'll now hand over to Ed for an update on ERC, collateral, and the asset management platform. Ed.
Thank you, Chris. So I'll outline more detailed analysis on our ERC base, and then we'll describe how our operational platform is continuing to develop to address challenges and maximize opportunities in our book. So starting with page 16, a breakdown of our ERC by geography and asset type, and a comparison to the previous period last year. This is a page that many of you will be familiar with. Our ERC base continues to be diversified by geography, with Italy, Spain, and Portugal our key markets, and diversified by asset type, across both secured and unsecured, and by type of borrower. Over the page on slide 17 is a breakdown of our ERC based on an analysis of underlying line level position by position data. Of our $523 million ERC, $118 million is unsecured. $25 million is backed by cash in court, i.e. sale proceeds from underlying real estate currently in the court distribution process, and $380 million is secured, backed by real estate. This $380 million of secured ERC is backed by significant collateralization, with underlying asset values of $623 million. This collateral is highly diversified. By size of property, on the top right-hand side, you'll see the distribution of collateral value by size of property, and it's distributed across a range of different bands. It's also diversified by type of property. On the bottom right-hand side, you'll see the distribution by type of property, a concentration in residential, as you would expect, but with a proportion of commercial, land, and other asset classes. I'll now go on to describe in more detail how in each key geography there is significant coverage and diversity in our underlying collateral. So starting with Italy on page 18, of our $205 million of ERC in Italy, $84 million is unsecured, $14 million is backed by cash in court, and $107 million is secured. The collateral backing our secured ERC is $233 million. The high coverage ratio of collateral value to ERC reflects the dynamics of our Italian back book, where we have assumed a defensive resolution path via the judicial auction process, hence the significant headroom to collateral value. Our collateral base in Italy is highly diversified by type of property, with a predominance of residential assets, by size of property, and by region, with a prevalence of collateral value in the centre and south of the country. Over the course of 2019, we have consistently outperformed our ERC expectations on an asset-by-asset basis, delivering asset resolutions in Italy at 108% of plan, i.e. 8% ahead of individual asset ERC targets. Moving on to Portugal, over the page, 114 million of ERC, 26 million is unsecured, 6 million is backed by cash in court, and 82 million is secured. The collateral value backing our secured ERC is 158 million. This high coverage of collateral value to ERC is driven by our secured SME book, where a defensive judicial strategy drives a prudent approach to our estimation of liquidation value. Our collateral base in Portugal is highly diversified, highly granular, with 92% of assets residential and a concentration in the 0 to 100k size of property bands. A concentration in Lisbon, as you would expect, with value across Porto and the Algarve. Again, over the course of 2019, we've consistently outperformed our ERC expectations, delivering asset resolutions at 102% of plan, i.e. 2% ahead of individual asset ERC targets. And finally, Spain. Our entire ERC base of 140 million is secured. This ERC is backed by 154 million of collateral value. Our collateral in Spain is highly diversified, with diversity by type of collateral, circa 50% of assets are residential, and by size of properties, with a large number of granular assets alongside some selected large positions, and also by region, focused on the three key cities in the south of Spain. You will observe a lower coverage ratio between collateral value and ERC in Spain. This is due to the fact that our valuation methodology in Spain is based on a prudent liquidation value for a for sale as opposed to a more standard market valuation. And again, like in Italy and Portugal, over the course of 2019, we've consistently outperformed our ERC expectations, delivering asset resolutions at 103% of plan, i.e. 3% ahead of individual asset ERC targets. In summary, we remain confident in our ERC with continued proof points in our ability, despite timing challenges, to deliver asset resolutions ahead of plan from a diverse and significant pool of underlying collateral. Moving on to the next section, asset management, I'll now outline the recent and planned developments in our asset management platform. So if you turn to page 22. Over the past quarter, there has been continued investment in our local on-the-ground resources. Our Lisbon office was launched at the end of the summer and now has three experienced resources focusing on the tactical oversight of our servicing panel. We have continued to develop Galata, bringing in real estate specialists. Phoenix Asset Management continues to expand, now up to 46 FTE across Rome and Milan. The asset management team has access to a deep pool of analytical resource to support with the ongoing optimization and refinement of portfolio strategies, a team of data scientists in the London office, a pool of over 30 resources in Delhi focused on data operations, database administration, and analytics. Over the coming months, we will consolidate our asset management capabilities further within AIFE through the incorporation of resources from the UK and Luxembourg. This will consolidate within AIFE a pan-European platform comprising dedicated AIFE resources in UK, Luxembourg, Italy, Spain, and Portugal, and over 300 dedicated resources at third-party servicing partners. This platform will manage AIFE assets, but can also generate fee income through provision of asset management services to ANICAP credit funds and third parties. Moving to slide 23, the investments in the platform are designed to continue to optimize performance in existing and future assets. For existing assets, our key focus areas are servicing internalization. In Spain, we have internalized part of our residential and SME secured books within Galata, to ensure heightened focus and intensity mitigates any further timing delays. Our second focus, the tactical management of key positions, close engagement with our servicing partners to ensure we can maximize asset recovery on large positions, and finally, the ongoing optimization of marketing strategies for real estate. We will continue to develop this platform for the management of future portfolios, extending servicing internalization, where we can demonstrate that we outperform market benchmarks, and extending our real estate management capabilities in support of direct management of real estate positions and the active packaging and sale of real estate positions and sub-portfolios. So in summary, an increasing depth and breadth of operational capability to address challenges and opportunities in our book. I will now hand over to Justin to give an overview of strategy and outlook for ACE.
Thanks, Ed. Turning to slide 25 for more on the outlook for ACE. In 2019, ANICAP completed a successful fundraising for its fourth credit opportunities fund. Predating the establishment of ACE in 2017, ANICAP has consistently deployed capital over the past decade across a range of predominantly seasoned, highly diversified credit, establishing strong local networks, underwriting, and servicing expertise across asset types. Whilst NPL investment has always formed a significant component of ANICAP's broader credit investment strategy, as highlighted in red on the chart in the slide, we have also consistently deployed capital in non-core performing loans, structured credit, as well as increasingly in single-name corporate credit and real estate, as we have continued to evolve incrementally across the European credit universe in seeking the best risk-adjusted returns. With more than 80% of overall invested capital across asset types deployed in core geographies, including the UK, Italy, Portugal, and Spain. After further developing ANICAP's asset management operations within ACE over the past year, the company will look to incrementally expand investments in these directly adjacent asset types, co-investing alongside ANICAP's credit opportunities funds, much as it continues to do so in NPLs. As illustrated on slide 26, ANICAP maintains a large pipeline of not only NPLs, but across these varied asset types, with more than 50% in core geographies, including selectively in well-known Central and Eastern European geographies and potential new markets. As previously discussed, ANICAP's NPL focus includes a growing pipeline of REO opportunities as banks increasingly look to accelerate the disposal of repossessed assets as well as secondary portfolios emerging now in Italy as well. Our growing real estate pipeline also includes high-quality single assets with funding constraints or in need of repositioning in markets where we have extensive real estate secured NPL workout experience. The performing loan pipeline is focused on seasoned, highly diversified, and cash-generative consumer, SME, and secured corporate debt deemed non-core by sellers. In total, ANICAP's current credit pipeline, including live potential transactions where we have at least been able to complete a preliminary analysis and valuation, is almost 2 billion euros of potential invested capital, offering a vast supply of opportunities from which to cherry pick, co-investing alongside ANICAP's credit opportunities funds to ensure we're able to capitalize on the best risk-adjusted returns, but also maintain a high degree of overall diversification. Finally, on slide 27, as outlined earlier, the shortfall in 2019 collections is buffered by what remains a highly diversified underlying pool of cash in court and real estate collateral. Over the past year, ANICAP has also continued to develop its asset management operations within ACE to ensure that by marrying analytics with an increasing number of boots on the ground engaged across our servicing panel, we can continue to optimize recoveries and rapidly address performance challenges where they arise. The non-cash impairment primarily relates to addressable timing challenges in legacy secured portfolios, with strong continued performance on more recent acquisitions as outlined earlier. We do remain acutely focused on the potential impact of COVID-19 on collections in at least the short term as challenges arise across Italy and elsewhere. Whilst forecast collections in Q1 are seasonally low and we're on track through February, a potential slowdown heading into Q2 and beyond could lead to shortfalls and a temporary increase in leverage. Fortunately, AIF maintains strong embedded collections on its predominantly secured existing portfolio, with a leverage target of between 3 and 3.5 times expected to be achieved by the end of 2021, and over 460 million euros of existing ERC forecast between now and the end of 2023. Whilst we remain disciplined in deployment given the current backdrop, AIF has significant available liquidity to pursue new opportunities across both NPLs as well as directly adjacent asset types, where ANICAP has a broader-based track record. Thank you for listening, and now we'll take questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question on today's call, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, it is star 1 to ask a question. We'll now take our first question from Rory McLaughlin of GSO Capital. Please go ahead.
Thanks for the presentation. A couple of questions for me. Just what percentage of your collections in H1 will be stemming from Italy? And then just could you give some color on the jump in liquidity then in the first 2 months of February? Then also, is there any guidance on purchases for 2020? And just obviously you've mentioned co-investments, but what percentage do you reckon of purchases going forward will be co-investments? And then final question, just looking at some of the collections, obviously they've been pushed out for 4 or 5 years, and given the vast majority of these collections are court mandated, I'm just wondering, could you talk through why they were extended out by so long? Thanks.
Rory, thanks for your questions, and I'll try and get them in order. So in terms of our collections forecast for the first half, I'll just give you the quarter numbers, because those are by quarter. So Q1 total collections are 17.2 million, and Q2 is 32.5 million. And then the Italy amounts within those two numbers are 5.9 and 14.2.
Yeah. In terms of the outlook for deployment, I think Chris mentioned we are budgeting 100 million of portfolio purchases for 2020. In terms of how we arrive at that number, we are co-investing. So if you look at 2019, everything we did, the 36.5 million euros we invested were co-investments alongside ANICAP's Credit Opportunities Fund. In doing so, we're obviously able to stretch our capital across a wider, more diversified portfolio in roughly equal proportion. We expect of the 100 million alongside ANICAP's broader funds, the rough split is typically about one-third in AIF and about two-thirds in the opportunities funds, which is down to the proportional relative size of the two vehicles.
Take the final question on court timings. The individual line-level estimates that we've gone through as part of our revaluation process look both at the underlying court with which a particular case is sat, as well as the degree of complexity in that particular case. So we've taken a prudent approach by looking at each individual case, by looking at the dynamics of a particular court, especially in Italy and Spain, where the majority of that extension is.
Rory, did we answer all of your questions there? Because you ran off quite a long list.
Yeah, it's more so actually to jump on liquidity. There seems to be a pretty significant jump just in the first 2 months.
Yeah, so if you've been looking at the statutory accounts and then you're looking at liquidity today, clearly December is always a big month for us, even though we missed our target. So you've got within receivables cash held at services, which by end of February has flowed through into liquidity.
Great, thanks.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you find that your questions have been answered, you may remove yourself from the queue by pressing star 2. And as a reminder, to ask a question, it is star 1. We'll now take our second last question from Frank Lehman of Thilo. Please go ahead.
Yes, hi, gentlemen, and thank you for taking my My questions. First of all, the review, that was a biannual review, if I read that right. Can you just remind me what the result was 2 years ago? And is it true we will do another biannual review, or we'll see the result of such in fourth quarter 2021 then? So that was my first question.
Let me answer that. So we do a detailed review every 6 months, and if necessary, and we're seeing deviations from run rates or forecasts at each quarter, so the March and September as well. So it's a regular process, not every other year. It's every 6 months is the line by line, and where necessary, we also do it at the quarter ends. So that what you can see from the track record that there have been various impairments over time, and you can either see those in the OM or in our previous historic financials.
Okay. Thank you. Second question, something where I'm struggling a little bit with the overall strategy of the fund, and that is, it seems like you under-allocated in 2019, therefore the ERC came down because, of course, you did not spend money to add to the ERC bucket. I can see that the result is also, of course, a weaker EBITDA. I can see that. Now, on the same side, I do not see a significant reduction in debt. The debt reduction is, give it 17, 18 million or so. What's missing here? What am I missing in terms of my thinking? Is the capital tied up through the discount rate or through the longer collection rate, or what has happened?
Should I not have seen a higher reduction
in net debt, Chris? That's what I'm asking.
There are a couple of things. Mm-hmm. That you won't see, obviously, but if you look at the financials, you'll find them. One is there was some deferred consideration that was paid in 2020 for an acquisition made in 2019, and clearly, mm-hmm. which is around 10 or 12 million. Then you'll also see a dividend of 10 million as well.
Overlapping items coming from So in a normal going situation, the debt would have been more like 325 instead of 345. Okay.
And then
I took note of the dividends in 2020.
I was just going to add that in terms of underallocated, obviously we did have a higher budget for 2019, and we do have excess liquidity beyond what we would expect to have at the end of the year, given the lower level of deployment. This mm-hmm. is predominantly down to the fact, not due to a lack of supply. I think our run rate in terms of the deals that we originated and priced last year was similarly high to the prior years. But we simply, I think from a pricing perspective, have maintained fairly high targets, and we did not win as many deals as we intended mm-hmm. to win over the course of 2019. It wasn't for lack of focus. We have a very strong pipeline, again, as I outlined earlier. We do believe there's some opportunities historically that we've not invested in AIFE. AIFE was set up initially, much like we set up our opportunities funds at ANICAP, with a principal focus on NPLs, but just as we've gradually over time expanded the focus in our opportunities fund, so too do we expect to do so in AIFE. And we think this will increase the opportunities for deployment. Of course, we expect to remain highly disciplined in anything we do, and probably more so than ever given the current backdrop.
And last question, you mentioned the 100 million to the previous caller. That was the 100 million as of AIFE and not as of including the co-investment. Yes. That's your number, so to say.
Exactly.
The number here.
AIFE portion, correct.
Okay, and that has led to the fact that you're pushing further out the long-term leverage target of 3 to 3.5, because that's not doable this year with 100 million. If you invest 100 million, you will not be at 3 and 3.5, right?
No, we're near a 4, just over 4. And it's part. Mm-hmm. It's principally driven by the lower than anticipated collections that we've got, but still a desire to end up with a growth in our ERC. Because obviously, you know, we are forecasting better collections in 2021, even from existing assets. So there's quite a, you know, I know you would have heard this last time, but there should be a drop. I certainly believe our forecasts are more prudent and that that will result in a drop in leverage in 2021.
All right. And last point from my side, of course, you always have a good opportunity to buy up your own bonds. I just saw them trading at 81 or whatever. And with a four and a half year maturity, you can put the money in here and achieve a 10% IRR. I think that's roughly what it is. And you mentioned, you did allude to the possibility that there might be some bond buybacks. I heard that. All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll now take our next question from Helen Rodriguez. Please go of CreditSight Incorporated. Please go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks very much for the questions. I was just looking at the papers, and there's all sorts of stories about debt holidays for SMEs and individuals. And I just wondered, I mean, does that affect you at all? And just generally, given the sort of more benign environment that such a crisis creates, you've mentioned the sort of delays in the court side. Is there any other impacts to your sort of business operations that you could envisage?
Well, I think first off, most of what you're seeing in terms of relief will be focused on performing loans and contracts that have not defaulted. Obviously, the focus on AIF has been NPLs, so we don't think there'll be a direct impact there. Certainly, I think what we alluded to earlier is absolutely the focus for us is the high number, you know, and the reliance upon court proceedings and court-appointed auctions. There is a suspension in Italy currently. There may be suspensions elsewhere to come, or at least delays. So I think from an AIF perspective, it's those considerations that are primary focus for us.
Sure. And then in terms of the sort of cash, I forget the figure that you mentioned, that's actually in court at the moment. What's the sort of how long is that particular chunk of cash, or how often does it turn over? It's probably the other way of thinking about it.
Yeah, the typical turnover rate for that cash in court is around 12 to 18 months, and it varies by jurisdiction, and within each jurisdiction it varies by court timing.
And when you talk about your collateral, what's the precise basis of valuation for your collateral? And obviously, you know, with the sell-off we've had in markets and so on, would you bring forward your collateral valuation exercise on the basis of, you know, if there's a sort of mark-to-market generally of assets?
Yeah, through the revaluation process, which takes place formally every 6 months, we constantly review collateral values. The basis for the collateral values, as I described earlier, is based on an open market valuation of a particular property.
Who does that?
It's typically third-party valuation firms. Whenever we would underwrite a secured portfolio, we would engage third-party independent advisors to support with the valuation process and provide independent.
Is that local firms or is that sort of international real estate guys?
We rely on local expertise, yes.
Okay.
I think there is a difference between country. So certainly in Spain, it's more of a the values reflect more of the position the asset's in, where in Italy, the values are more of a willing buyer and willing seller, and then you apply the court of an auction discount process to the timing.
Got it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll now take our next question from Nikita Fedyuk of Soundpoint. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Can I just clarify on page 9 for the reasons, for the exact reasons in each of the three countries? So in Spain, there was a delay, there was a change in the legislation. Could you, I just want to make sure that I got it correctly. What exactly happened there?
It's not just that. It was there's been for some time there's been a ongoing situation for consumer credit for consumers that have said that the banks foreclosed on their mortgages too early, and that was an abusive act, and that went all the way up to the European Court, who came back with a judgment that in summary said, yes, in some cases the banks got it wrong, but in other cases they got it right. So it wasn't particularly helpful. But as a consequence of that going through the European courts, a lot of cases that were in the courts were suspended by the courts pending the outcome of the ECJ ruling. Because the ECJ ruling wasn't clear, the Spanish courts, the Spanish government introduced a new Mortgage Act that laid out very precise rules on what was abusive and what wasn't abusive, i.e. if you missed just one payment, it was inappropriate for a bank to foreclose on a mortgage. That was then interpreted by the various courts across Spain towards the end of November. The key result is now that all of that's clear and released, there's a very large backlog of cases that have restarted, not necessarily by assets owned by us, but the general restructuring that's been happening in the Spanish market. There are a huge number of cases that are now flooding the courts. And as a result, rather than being at the front of the queue, we're now in the middle of the queue, and therefore trying to progress things through the courts is taking longer than we had previously anticipated.
I see. And this ruling by the European Court, you said, was at the beginning of 2019.
The ruling was the ECJ ruling was March 19, but it was not a particularly clear ruling, and therefore went up to the new Mortgage Act in June 19. Supreme Court interpreted that at the end of September 19 to provide clarity back to the courts, and then the two large courts, Barcelona and Madrid, interpreted the Spanish Supreme Court's interpretation in November, and that's now released, given that all of these suspended cases that were suspended have now flooded back into the courts.
All of which were compounding delays, but obviously, as Chris mentioned, the clarity today is helpful, but certainly we had to be prudent in our expectation of how rapidly things will move going forward.
I see. Thank you. And what happened in Italy?
Yeah, Italy, it's principally driven by our back book, so the pre-2017 vintages, where we have made an assumption based on observations that a number of cases will need to pass through one more auction cycle in the Italian judicial process. It's driven by prudency, and that effect drives that shift in timing that you observe in Italy.
So you were just a bit aggressive at the time of pricing, is that correct?
Well, I think probably more importantly, we also have the benefit of quite a bit more data at this point in terms of our historical performance. So, I mean, we have had some positive surprises in our Italian book as well, but when you look at the breadth of history now on those earliest vintages, we certainly have a lot more data to complete a reforecast today, and we think we're prudent in doing so.
I see. Thank you. And could you please comment on what happened in Portugal then?
Yeah, there's three effects. I think an uplift in our unsecured book, which has been supported by improvements in the Portuguese economy, by improvements in the legislative environment and increase in run rates. In our residential secured book, a change in strategy. So we've seen that the judicial sale environment, i.e. Securing asset sales for properties prior to the repossession process, has been a much more productive and cost-effective route of resolution than originally anticipated. And thirdly, our SME secured book, where we have, again, through prudency, move timing from 2020 into 2021 to reflect latest information about a number of cases in our book, especially those in later stages of bankruptcy, which we think will now take a little bit more time to process through the court system.
So it wasn't clear why it would take for these portfolios longer through the court system.
It's just based on an individual line level review of each particular case, based on its the observed trajectory it's achieved through 2019, and our detailed line level expectation of where that case will conclude over the next 12 to 24 months.
I see, but there were no change in the court system similar to Spain. There was something.
No significant macro changes in the Portuguese court system. No.
So the reason looks like it's more similar to Italy, right?
Correct. Yes.
I see. Could you please clarify what is the kind of top three largest claims that you have in your ERC?
We don't really give individual positions, but we have a. You can see that we obviously have some large balances, but we don't really discuss individual positions.
Thank you. We'll now take our next question from Niall Considine of Man GLG. Go ahead.
Hi there. Actually, just following on the previous question to start with, I'm looking at page 9, and by the way, thank you very much.
Sorry, unfortunately, we can't hear you.
We're struggling to hear you.
Sorry, is that better?
Yeah, it's much better.
Apologies. All right, I'll start again. I was looking at page 9 as a follow-on from the previous question, and thank you for the granularity you've provided. That is very helpful. So if I think about Portugal, I mean, it's smaller than Spain in terms of ERC, but a bigger reforecast impact, despite the fact that Spain has the court backlog issue. So can you just elaborate a little bit further on your answer just now? Should we interpolate from that whether it's prudence or whatever you want to call it, but that sort of Portugal and the data points you've been sort of collecting over the last year or two leads you to conclude it's sort of less easy to collect or perhaps less successful to collect than you might have expected?
That would be the wrong interpretation, actually. Portugal as a country and our performance in Portugal is very strong. So really, if you go back to the case study analysis, first of all, look at deployment in 2018, and you'll see on page 11 that 58 million out of the 162 was in Portugal. So a significant proportion of what we purchased in 2018 is in Portugal. And then if you go back and look on page 13, where we're giving that in aggregate, but it's largely impacted by, but certainly some of the changes in timings and the change in the shape of the curves is principally driven in Portugal. So the Portuguese portfolio got off to a really cracking start. You can see from the 2018, we're significantly ahead in terms of collections, but very, very significantly ahead in terms of profit contribution. So whether it's a modelling exercise or the fact that the Portuguese economy has taken off a lot faster than we realised. Underwriting, it was a fairly cautious approach that we would go through a very legal phase, we'd repossess all the properties, we'd put all those properties on our book, and we'd sell them quickly. What's transpired is that because the economy is doing very well, actually it's much easier and significantly cheaper. And although from accounting that doesn't help me in terms of impairment, actually to run a much steadier ship, go through the judicial processes, rather than repossess the property, pay all the back taxes, pay all the stamp duty, pay all the administrators to administrate real estate insurance that's mandatory in Portugal, et cetera, it's much more cost effective and benefit to overall profitability to run this judicial process because it's proving highly effective. But overall, Portugal, we're extremely pleased about. The unsecured book is significantly overperforming as minimum wage rates have increased and we've seen a big uptick in payments on that. And the very large Portuguese portfolio that we purchased in 2018 is very strong.
Okay. Thank you. That's very helpful. And then turning to the detail on the secured portfolio, and once again, very helpful detail. First question, I guess, is when you talk about the higher LTV in Spain versus the other two countries, because you're measuring to a different thing, can you give us a sense for what the delta between the sort of prudent for sale valuation that you use is and what the market value would be? And then I guess sort of how comparable would that delta be in sort of Portugal and Italy as well?
So I think, as I alluded to earlier on, the outperformance that we're seeing is pretty consistent across all three geographies, 108% in Italy, 102% in Portugal, 103% in Spain, all versus our individual ERC target. So we would expect to see a similar coverage ratio between a pure open market value in Spain and as that which we observe in Portugal and Italy. And similarly, if we look today, for sale asset is where it is, valuation in Portugal and Italy, we would see a similar dynamic in Portugal and Italy to that which we see in Spain.
I think one thing that is worth focusing on is the peculiarity of the Italian auction process, where property auctions are set at a market value that is often deemed, in our view, would be somewhat inflated for where liquidity would actually be available at an auction, which is cash buyers, not in the normal course of business where someone could, say, get a mortgage financing arranged, you can run a normal marketing procedure. But having to start at a market value is part of how the process works, specifically in Italy. It's then marked down through successive auctions if it does not clear. So often you have to start with a normal market clearing price, but then you have to allow it to progress through the auction procedure until it reaches a liquidation value. So that is what's reflected in the higher starting price market value. Of course, where we can try to achieve better than liquidation levels, like, for example, selling things outside of auctions, we, of course, try to do that. But our forecasting is typically based on a prudent assumption that it's going to go through the full judicial procedure and auction process before clearing. And that's somewhat different from Spain, where we don't have to set such a high auction price, but we seek a valuation, which is where we believe we can achieve liquidity for that particular asset in that particular location relative to specific comps as well.
Okay. Okay, that's helpful. And I guess following on from that, can you give us some sense for the LTV distribution? So it's obviously very helpful to know that the average LTV is 61%. But I guess what would be more useful again is kind of what percent of secured assets is the LTV above 80, above 90, above 100? Just so we can get a sense for the tail.
I'm not sure if you look at LTVs per se. Are you talking about the discount between the difference between the market value and the liquidation, or because that's not an LTV in terms of the loan balance? That's purely the property value versus our own forecasted cash recovery.
If I'm looking, so I think of 380 million of secured NPLs backed by 623 million of asset value, but obviously that's not sort of evenly distributed. So when I think about LTV, and tell me if I'm structurally thinking about this wrong, I'm looking at sort of 380 million loans supported by that collateral value, but I'm trying to get a sense of the non-linearity of distribution.
No, I think what you're looking here is actually 380 million of resolution value, which would be simply a discount of where we sell the property. The actual loan balance against that property value much closer to the market value or below of property, because a lot of these, by nature, by definition, a lot of these loans would have had north of 100% LTV when they defaulted, or today, if not when they defaulted. So this is, 380 is not equivalent to a loan balance, but it's equivalent to our cash recovery assumption.
Yeah, sorry, yes. No, I understand that, but what I'm saying is that 380 against 623 isn't exactly the same proportion asset to asset. So some of what you expect to collect in that 380 is less supported, right? Is that correct,
When we look at the, it reflects, as Justin said, the particular resolution paths and judicial dynamics per jurisdiction. When we look at this ratio across different deals, you know, certainly in Italy, we see a pretty similar formula and a pretty similar level, you know, ratio of ERC or resolution value versus collateral value. And we can definitely look at providing some, you know, some further detail on that distribution further down the line.
And we certainly have LTVs underlying that would range from in the 90s to north of 150%, just to give you some context where some of these loans would be significantly, you know, underwater as a starting point. And obviously, we'll have to consider the maximum recoverable amount based on the loan balance as well. So you'd see a high degree of variability within the book for, say, a more recently defaulted Portuguese residential loan versus, say, a 15-year-old loan in the Italian market where you had maybe a highly inflated market value at the time of the loan was originated.
Okay. That's helpful, and yeah, more granularity going forward would be really helpful. Obviously, what we try to do is sensitize, you know, X percent decline in asset value and figure out what that does for the portfolio, and you need to have some sense of the distribution for that. Last question, if I can push my luck. I guess following on from the comment you made earlier, the question earlier about where your debt is trading, I mean, I guess, can you talk a little bit, just big picture, if you think about sort of preferred uses of capital between debt buybacks, between buying portfolios, between dividends, between, you know, acquisitions, can you just talk a little bit of how you think about the relative attractiveness of those different uses of capital right now?
Just, I can maybe start with that. I mean, certainly our target return requirements remain comfortably in excess of what we could achieve by buying back debt. We are conscious of leverage. We are conscious of where we are in the market cycle. So certainly I'm not saying we would never consider that from a prudent capital structure management standpoint. But, I mean, our preference is certainly to deploy capital on new investments to grow the business, to increase profitability. We still believe there's a very large pipeline to accomplish that. I think maybe one of the challenges last year where we actually were pushing our return targets out incrementally throughout the course of the year because we do feel like the market was moving in the right direction, and perhaps we were a bit too conservative in that, and we caught ourselves deploying a bit less capital than we expected. But we did believe it was the right thing to do because probably as you've heard elsewhere in the market, we think that returns are moving in the right direction. We don't think we're seeing the same levels of asset chasing or overbidding that we were seeing a year or two ago. However, I think we're trying to find the right balance, and I think we've been incrementally adjusting, you know, throughout the course of the last, you know, 18 months considerably. And we're cautiously optimistic, let's say. It's not that there's not competition in the world, but we certainly see a continued positive movement, and we will continue to remain disciplined in targeting price.
Yeah, I think I'll just add to that. I would just say, sitting here with the COVID-19 virus spreading across Italy, preservation of liquidity is probably my key concern as CFO at the moment. So unlikely to do anything in the short term. And clearly, you know, we'd much rather build the business and see some growth than manage the capital structure. But we do look at it, and we are conscious of the various returns that are available in the market. But I think given the very short-term uncertainty in the markets at the moment, we want to preserve some liquidity for opportunities that may arise.
Thank you. We'll now take our next question from Sonal Sodhi of Morgan Stanley. Please go ahead.
Yes, hi. Good afternoon. Just first question was on the $100 million deployment you talk about. So just going back to your last comment, so is that flexible given that what you mentioned around COVID, Italy and Spain exposure, so would you be able to adjust that, or is that committed?
Yeah, that's 100% within our control. You know, we forecast it zero in Q1, 30%, 30%, 40%. But you know, events are moving very fast. We don't have to spend any money at all, or we could spend more earlier if the right opportunity arose. So that's completely something that's 100% within our control.
We have a relatively small amount of capital in terms of new deployment in advanced stage of pipeline. They're not deals that we have to complete, but they're deals that we still may look to complete, but it's relatively small and single-digit percentage of the overall targets. So absolutely, we can maintain prudence for the foreseeable future if necessary.
Just one point, clearly, unlike some of the large debt purchasers, we don't have a big overhead to feed. We don't have hundreds of people at call centers that we need to pump volume through in. Our cost base is completely flexible. It's driven by assets under management and outsourced to services. So we've got a very variable cost base.
And no forward purchasing commitments either in terms of forward flow commitments currently. So that there's no capital we have to deploy.
Okay. Yeah. No. So just going to the second question, that was more around the cost. So when we will see the EBITDA come down this year, so it won't be such a hit in terms of margin. It's just that it flows down from lower gross collection. So you won't like see a similar level of cost base, but cost base would also adjust lower this year, given collections are lower. So there is variability in that.
Yeah. I mean, although collections are lower than previously estimated, we are still anticipating, subject to my comments about COVID-19, there would normally be, in a normal course of business, a modest uptick in adjusted EBITDA. But clearly, obviously, we're waiting to see what's going to happen in Italy.
Got it. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll now take our next question from Benjamin Pesquier of TKO. Please go ahead.
Thanks. Thanks for taking questions. Most of mine have been answered by now, but maybe a follow-up on the relief measures that we talked about in Italy, but it's starting in Spain as well. Would you consider that investment opportunities if banks were starting to grow back their books of non-performing loans, or do you think that maybe the regulators would be a bit more comfortable with that and saying to banks that they can maybe not include them in their NPL books? And if it was to be considered NPL, do you think that it would be more longer term, so maybe 2021? And so is it included in your 2 billion pipeline, or is it completely...
No, I think the direct impact from the current market conditions is very difficult to forecast forward. I actually think there has been talk and consideration that there may be some, for lack of a better word, leniency around both borrowers in terms of not allowing mispayments and not considering them defaults. There could be knock-on effects where regulators take the view, therefore, that they'll be more lenient with bank capital ratios and considerations. I mean, a fundamental change, however, of policy and provisioning, I think that's a much bigger step, and it's difficult to say at this point whether that it would proceed to that. So I think the answer is we think it'll help cushion the blow in terms of near-term credit performance, but we certainly don't think we can forecast yet any longer-term impact on bank balance sheets. Nothing in that current pipeline, which was prior to the recent events emerging, all that pipeline has been in there for at least several weeks. Is a direct result of any of the current market conditions. If anything, I would say the pipeline may slow down a bit because I'm not sure sellers are going to want to risk completing transactions unless they're absolutely forced to do so and potentially get lower pricing than they had expected. I would expect sellers would try to wait for some normalization in market conditions where possible before completing sales. But obviously, these things are moving quickly, so certainly we're going to continue to look out for opportunities.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. We'll now take our next question from Amar Suna of DE Shaw. Please go ahead.
Hey, guys. Just a couple of clarifications on the glossary for me, so it should be quick. With regards to ERC, is that pure gross collections on the portfolios and then the net collections that are coming from your interest in the notes?
That's true. So, unfortunately, due to lots of technical accounting rules, we've got various ways of structuring investments in effectively the same things. It's gross collections on it's effectively what we get to receive.
Yep. And then your collection activity costs are servicing fees plus all other servicing related costs like judicial costs and other things, but not including AFE staff costs and overheads and things. So these are pure
correct.
Collection costs related to the portfolios.
But where it says collection activity costs, that's correct. When we're talking about our total operating cost ratio that's referred to at the front of the presentation, that's including all overheads.
Inclusive of the collection activity costs?
Inclusive of the collection activity costs. So the 25% is inclusive of all overheads.
And does that include the management fee payout as well? Or is
yes,
staff
it does. Yeah, everything.
Yeah, everything. Okay.
The only thing it excludes is any non-recurring items, which were pretty immaterial in 2019.
Yeah, great. And then just last question. I noticed the you've in addition to the super senior RCF, you've got the term loan and secured loan notes on your balance sheet. How do they rank relative to the bond?
So the secured loan notes are effectively they are junior in a way because they represent the amount owed to third-party co-investors where we have investments that we own in an entity that we own 100% of, and they're entitled to a share of collections. So it's effectively a pass-through. And that clearly we don't include their share in ERC either. So it sort of comes in and goes out. The term facility is non-recourse asset finance, so it's secured on certain portfolios, but with no recourse to any other assets.
Oh, got it. And who provides the term facility?
NatWest.
Thanks very much. That's all for me.
Thank you. We'll now take our next question from Matt.
Can I just ask how many more questions we've got in the queue?
Last question, sir.
Okay. Fine. Thank you. We'll take one more then.
Of Dicker Hall Capital. Please go ahead.
Thank you for taking my question. I just really want to clarify how much of your collections are at risk given what's happening in Italy and what might happen in Spain. In other words, is there a non-paying part of your portfolio and a paying part? And in that case, can you just estimate that? I assume SMEs are non-paying generally, but consumer must be paying, right?
Well, I think everything that we own, pretty much everything that we own is non-paying because they're basically NPLs. But if I look at our Italian book, then 2.5 million out of the 5.9 million is from our unsecured portfolios, where we have cambiales, we have more regular payments, and that might continue more than perhaps something that's event-driven on the secured portfolio. Mm-hmm. We also have a similar amount, or about $1 million a quarter, in the Portuguese market. The rest is mostly secured and event-driven is probably the wrong word, but
non-paying,
but it's non-paying and secured. Yeah. And if the courts are
there's
shut,
nothing has payment plan. Yeah,
no, nothing's on a payment plan.
Okay.
I mean, those Portuguese and Italian examples you mentioned, those are payment plans, but that's a relatively small portion.
Yeah.
But when you say non-paying, I think the key difference is we don't have significant in our ERC forecast overall. Significant non-paying unsecured component. It'd be that when we talk about the non-paying positions, it's predominantly secured by real estate. So yes, timing considerations where we've been prudent recently, which we think, you know, is helpful that we've pushed out our forecasts from where they were, but nevertheless, very difficult to determine right now how long further timing delays might be. And we're certainly seeing in the next 1 to 2 months, without question, there's going to be considerable delays in Italy at least.
Okay, understood. Thank you very much for clarifying that.
Okay, I think we will draw the line to questions there. Again, if you have got any questions, you can send them through the website at info@anacapfe.com. Thank you very much, everybody.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's call. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.